Welcome back to the Product People Show. It is 2018, brand new year. Hope you had a great holiday. I'm back today with an interview with Josh Nielsen from Zencastr. You're really going to like this one, especially because Josh is very humble. He has all these comments like this.
I think there are some good takeaways, but I really do think like most of it is like, A, I got lucky, and B, I just kind of kept moving.
So with honesty like that, you know it's going to be a good show. This show is sponsored by Mega Maker Club. This is my community for product entrepreneurs, developers, designers, anyone looking to launch their own thing. Megamaker.co/club. We don't always have registration open, but it is open right now, just in time for you to kick things off for the new year. All right, megamaker.co/club. It was previously Product People Club, but we changed the name. All right, let's get into this interview with Josh. I'm here with Josh Nielsen from Zencastr. How's it going, Josh?
Hey, how's it going?
And where are you calling from today?
I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Salt Lake City, Utah. And the last time we talked, you were in Thailand. And I think that was, it was a couple years ago. And you had only been working on Zencastr for a little bit. Maybe just quickly describe what Zencastr is and who it's for.
Yeah, Zencastr basically helps podcasters record their remote guests in studio quality. And does this by doing what's called a double-ended recording, where you have everybody open up our web application, and when you hit record, it records everybody locally on their end and then sends you each a separate solo track per guest once you're done. And this is in contrast to what people commonly do, where they record with Skype, which can be subject to having VoIP artifacts and inconsistencies in the quality throughout the call due to the network conditions.
Yeah. And how did you come up with that idea in the first place? Like, how did you know that that was even something worth pursuing?
Well, I was pursuing a different idea where I was trying to make a digital audio workstation in the browser, because they just come out with all these neat tools to play with audio in the browser and synthesize audio and stuff like that. And, I just was starting to realize that A, it was really early for that idea, still is, and B, it was a huge amount of work. I was kind of just, it was half of a toy idea that maybe I would turn into a business at some point. And I just realized that, you need a team of people, and the platform needed to be much more mature for that to work. And then I found out I was having a baby. And so I was like, okay, I need a quicker path to revenue on, something that's simpler. And anyway, along that time, previously when I was working on an even earlier company, someone had told me, hey, I don't know about what you're doing here, but podcasters have this problem dealing with audio, getting their audio something. I didn't even really know what he meant. I didn't even really ask. I didn't care at the time, and because I was totally focused on what I was doing. But it kind of stuck in the back of my head. And when I was looking for a new idea, I was like, I wonder what I can take that will use my, the knowledge I've learned about this audio stuff in the browser and apply it to something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. That had a more kind of fixed scope, or so I thought. and so I knew some people who had podcasts, and I started asking them, hey, is there a problem here? What's going on? And as I started to hear them explaining, the problems that they had, I could see, that this brand new technology, would allow for a new solution that didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, I could build that in a couple, in a month. And so I started working on it. 6 months later, I had a beta for people to try out. And yeah, I kind of went from there.
So it took a little bit longer than you thought.
Yeah, yeah. I'm probably years behind where I thought I would be right now at this point, just because it's been such a crazy technical endeavor that has definitely put me in over my head a few times. And at the same time, you know, the browsers are still kind of shaping up how these APIs for doing the audio stuff works. And so things change every time they do a release. And so there's been a lot of kind of adapting, and it's kept me on my toes for sure.
And what year was that? That was 2014 when you started like talking to people and working on it?
Yep, November 2014.
Okay. And I just want to pause there because there's been this trend as I've talked to like more and more people. You started by kind of looking at this emerging technology in the browser and trying to build a business out of that. And then you realized that wasn't going to work. And it was in a human interaction that you'd had earlier that kind of ended up being the business idea. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely came kind of full circle from being, you know, trying to having a solution in search of a problem to then kind of hearing that what a real problem was and then adapting the solution to fit that, I think.
Yeah. And it just seems like sometimes, you know, especially people that are technical, we can really like be enchanted with new technology or enchanted with maybe a technical challenge. Mm-hmm. But in your case, it was like running into real human beings and these kind of almost like that was kind of a serendipitous moment, you know, that person reaching out to you and saying, hey, I don't know what the heck you're working on, but this is something I need.
And I mean, it totally was. It was actually at, just to give even more context, the company that I was working on at the time was called Soundkeep, and we were trying to build like a GitHub for music. Mm-hmm. And which we found out later, no one really wants. I mean, people kind of wanted, but there's a couple companies that have kind of carried the torch in a way there, but the way we were doing it was not at all workable. And musicians are quite different about their creations than programmers. But anyway, so I was actually at a Techstars for a day in San Antonio trying to pitch that company, when one of the mentors there was like, hey, I don't know, but hey, what about this? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was totally kind of out of left field, but it came as a part of the process of digging down on that previous problem. Even though it didn't end up being the right angle, it, you know, I wouldn't have heard that otherwise if I hadn't been trying to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's the question a lot of people have when they're getting started is like, where do ideas come from? And then as they're kind of growing their business, they're like, okay, well, where does like the improvement in a business come from? And
also, I think part of the lesson there, at least for me, was telling people about what you're doing is a lot mm-hmm. more valuable than trying to hide what you're doing.
Yeah,
because then people want to, you know, people can collaborate with you easier if they know what's going on. And so,
yeah. And until like, AI, AI robots start buying products, you have to interact with real human beings because they're the ones that are ultimately going to be taking out their credit card. Right.
Right.
So that like, if you're just keeping it to yourself and not actually getting it in front of people, even just the idea, getting the idea in front of people. Did you pitch Soundscape to any musicians? Like, did you try to get, like, see what their interest would be, you know, just talking to them? And, like, what was their feedback?
Well, I mean, yes and no. We definitely didn't do enough of that. The idea kind of came out of, we did the Node Knockout for like 2012 or 2011, I think. And we won the team prize for building this, collaborative beat sequencer.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I think is still alive. If you go to like ebb.sound, actually I forgot. We'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
My ebb.somethingcoded.com, I think we'll load it up.
Yeah.
And it's real simple, but it's a cool, real fun, like social experiment where people could make beats together live in real time.
Yeah.
And we're like, and you know, it was popular enough to win the contest, and it's like a popularity, whatever. Yeah. So like, oh, maybe there's something here. Maybe we've struck a chord or something. And so that's kind of where we got the confidence to move forward with some sort of an idea around music collaboration online.
Yeah.
But we didn't do nearly enough actually talking to, like, you know, people about, like, pulling out their wallet and, you know, what would really be valuable enough and not just a toy and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we came to find out that, yeah, it's fun to, like, do this jam thing together. But once musicians start actually, like, composing, they're very protective of their art. And they don't necessarily want to collaborate with just anybody. Like, the idea of just putting it out there and letting someone else mess with it was mm-hmm. really threatening to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea of, like, sharing it for free or, like, doing, like, a open source kind of an idea was not flying very well with, with many of them either. So, you know, that's kind of how that went.
Yeah. And so you've decided to investigate this idea of doing, you know, this podcast app. When you started working on it and you thought it would take you a month, did you do any marketing? Like, did you put up a landing page? Did you do any sort of validation work? Or were you just heads down working on this thing for 6 months?
You know, again, I didn't talk to like hundreds of people. Or even dozens, really. I talked to, like, I had, like, you know, five friends who are podcasters. And because I thought I could build it pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, you know, these guys seem to think there's a thing there. And I'll just build it and see what they think.
Yeah.
I think maybe most software developers have this problem of, like, vastly underestimating how long things will take. But that kind of let me blunder my way into it. Yeah. It was a bit of, you know, looking back on it, I basically got lucky that it worked. But, you know, at the end of the day, I was having fun. I didn't quit my normal job at that point.
Yeah.
I was doing contract development at the time. And so I just pared my hours back to like 20, 30 hours a week. And, you know, if it had flopped, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal.
Yeah. And did any of those initial friends of yours, did they any of them become customers?
No. I don't think so. But what, you know, what it is kind of like, most of, like, one of them isn't podcasting anymore. The other one was not like a host. He was like a kind of the co-host on the show.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't the one that was really, his host, I think, has used the service. I haven't checked recently.
Yeah.
But the friends of theirs and that through that, their podcasting network that they're associated with are definitely, you know, paying users of the service. And, but yeah, no, it's kind of funny in that regard. Like, most of the people that I've worked with closely on, like, getting a lot of feedback, even through the beta plan, that were really, really helpful and, you know, excited about the service aren't paid users, I don't think, right now. But part of that is podcasters churn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a, you know, even if the service you're providing for them is perfect, you know, it takes a lot of work to keep a podcast going and staying involved with it and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one challenge to the business, I suppose.
Yeah. And the reason I bring that up is it's always interesting to hear, like, who people thought would be their customers and who ended up being their customers.
Yeah. I mean, another thing is I have a very liberal free plan. Too liberal, actually. We're probably going to have to rein that in a little bit at some point. And so,
people need to get in now.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of it. There's a lot of people that are even, like, using it for, you know, business purposes that are happy with the free plan. And that's okay for now because I want to try and offer some more follow-on services to bring those people into paid plans. And I've got some ideas about in the future how to monetize the free users as well. So I'm not super – as long as I can cover my costs and keep some growth going, I'm not super worried about getting every last dollar out of it right now. Mm-hmm. So, we'll
see. And so I want to kind of go back to something you said too. You mentioned briefly that you felt like you got lucky in a way. What do you mean by that? Like, what role did luck play?
I think I was just in the right plays at the right time. For instance, like right when this technology was shaping up, I kind of caught wind of this idea. This idea of doing a double-ended podcast recording has existed since, well, before podcasting. It's a radio technique. Mm-hmm. They used to radio stations. I mean, I think they still do this. They have sister stations in like other parts of the country or the world, where if they want to record two people talking, they'll have them, one person come into the studio over there, and then this person do it here, so they can get a good studio quality recording of each person, for later. So, because most of them are not live, like it sounds like on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is an existing idea, and even when I launched the beta for Zencastr, there was even, since podcasting was kind of heating up, right? Well, that's another thing I got lucky about, right? So from when I started till when I launched the beta, like Serial came out and a bunch of these, this big kind of resurgence and interest. But like there was a company called PodClear, and they were trying to capitalize on this new resurgence and interest, and they built desktop applications that do this. But you got all that, this friction about how to get them to install it and all this stuff. And it was kind of funny because I've since, like, you know, met these guys, great people, and I would have done the same thing in their situation. But when I launched the beta, within a week they announced that they were going to be working on a web version, because it was just it was like, you know, this is obviously where this tech is going.
Yeah.
And they ended up getting bought, and then by Blab, actually.
Interesting. Wow. And so, like, you were working on this November 2014. So obviously you didn't make any revenue on this in 2014. 2015 rolls around. So you launch in like April. Is that right?
Like May 2015. Yeah.
Okay. May 2015. And so, did you launch to paying customers? What was the launch like?
No, I ran it in a free beta forever, and I probably shouldn't have done that. I made probably things a lot harder on myself than I had to, but it's tough because, like, people don't care if your podcast recording software works like 80%, you know?
Yeah.
Like, stability and reliability is a huge part of it, and, you know, when I started building it, I didn't realize at the time it actually wasn't possible to do. And like it became possible as I was building it.
Yeah.
And so I've been really riding the bleeding edge of the technology. And I mean, there's still some, there's still some things that need, like, issues and problems that can happen in recordings, like with audio drift and things like that, that the browsers aren't, you know, they're going to be fixing it, but it's not there yet. And we're just going to have to kind of work through it until then.
So it ended up being a lot tougher than you thought, and you launched in May. And do you remember how many people you launched to? Like, who did you launch to? Did you have a waiting list, or was it just you just send it out to a few friends?
I had no waiting list. I sent it out to some friends. Nobody knew. Nobody cared. In the early, like, I don't know if there's a way to go back to this, but if you go back to like the early days of the Twitter, or of like people tweeting at me,
it was really rough.
Like, they were like, I remember when someone tweeted me, they're like, you need to wrap caution tape around this thing. Like, I was like, okay, I'm sorry, I'm trying my best here, it is beta, we're testing, you know. But, you know, as soon as it's available, there are some people that the beta thing scared off, but that's one thing to keep in mind is people, I don't know, it didn't register with a lot of people that like beta meant like experimental testing mode.
Yeah.
And so the pressure was on pretty early to like get it solid and reliable. Nobody was really using it initially or knew about it. I didn't launch to a big audience, but what I did do is I just went on Twitter and started searching for like people who were swearing at Skype about the audio quality on their podcast.
Nice. Yeah.
And so like expletive Skype or, you know, whatever podcast. And, you know, so I just sit on Twitter every day and had searches for those things. And then I would just tweet to him. And I had a decent amount of success just at least getting people to try it because mm-hmm. the problem was real.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in like countries like Australia or in South America where the internet is a lot less reliable.
Yeah.
It was a major pain point for those people. So yeah, that was kind of how I got the initial, you know, thing rolling.
Yeah. Just reaching out but, to people directly.
Yeah. After about, I didn't only did that for maybe the first few, you know, couple hundred, somebody product hunted it kind of early on mm-hmm. in that time period. And that took me to about 1,000, I think.
Yeah. July 12th, 2015.
Yeah. And so that was a good little boost, nothing huge, but you know, going from 200 to 1,000 was nice. And then, luckily, I mean, podcast, you know, the other thing is podcasting is just kind of, and podcasters are just social anyway. They've all got Twitter accounts. They're all on Facebook. They're talking about it in their show. They're having other podcasters on their show. So it's kind of naturally viral in that regard. So
yeah.
I haven't really had to do, so far I haven't done any real marketing. It's all been kind of organic word of mouth. And
yeah.
I think right now we're at something like 30,000 registered users or something like that.
Wow. Wow. So you launch and you get a couple hundred users, just kind of like you working Twitter and everything. And then July, you get up to 1,000. And since then, you've grown to 33,000.
So something like that, yeah.
And when did you, like, when was the first time you got paid? Like, when was the first time you had something people could pay for?
It wasn't until last November.
So November 2016.
Yeah. Which I think is like, you know, I think most people like probably laugh behind their backs at me about that. But, you know, I wanted it to be ready, and I wouldn't have even launched it then except for at some point, TechCrunch wanted to do an article on it, and they're like, do you have anything coming up that we can like do the article about? And I was like, I guess I might as well launch. And so we set a date, and man, I had to work through, you know, I had to miss several nights of sleep just to get the thing ready for that.
Yeah.
TechCrunch launch. And the article ended up being terrible. I'll probably never work with TechCrunch again.
Oh, really?
Did it
end up bringing in any users? So yeah, I'm looking at it right now. So November 13th, 2016. Yeah, did it end up helping you at all or not really?
Not really. I mean, they launched the thing was is I needed to launch on a, you know, on like a slow day. Because I already had a decent amount of users, so I had to do it on like a Sunday or like a Saturday night, Sunday morning, and they wanted to do the article right then, and so it was they posted the article at a bad time. TechCrunch readers are not necessarily like my target.
Yeah,
I don't know if I thought about that much at the time,
mm-hmm.
and you know they didn't ask me very much. You know they didn't do very good research.
Yeah.
And they used I gave them a bunch of new artwork. I just redesigned the site. They used the old stuff. So anyway,
that's interesting. I just want to kind of stick there for a while, just because I know for some people that would be the holy grail. It's like, oh, if I could only get on TechCrunch, then everything is going to be okay. Like I'll get thousands of users and that's basically the only thing stopping me from being successful is getting on TechCrunch. But I've heard other people have similar stories. Like it's not...
It's not that, I mean, at least for me, I don't think you'd even necessarily notice in my, you know, maybe I have my page visits were a little higher that day or something. It wasn't a substantial increase in my signups or anything like that.
Would you say that Product Hunt was better for you?
Yeah, probably. I'd have to look, but I mean, definitely at the time, Product Hunt made a bigger dent mm-hmm. in my, you know, in like, I don't know, percentage wise.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so you decide to launch November 2016. Do you remember, like, who was the first person to pay you? Or the first, is there,
I know who, I know who it is. I probably can't, like, you know, I don't know if they've revealed that they use Zencastr in public or not. So
okay, but was it, it was a beta user that was already on?
It was somebody who had used the service for a long time. I've got a lot of users who have been with it since early beta days. So, you know, there's some of them stuck around.
Yeah.
And yeah. Some of them, like, I think, something like the first month, let me just look real quick. It was like eight or 12,000. I think I was did $12,000 in revenue the first month.
Wow. See, that's pretty crazy. You know, maybe people made fun.
But I had been building up for a long time. Like, yeah. At that point, I don't remember, but it was something like at least 10,000 people in the registered users.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I had at least that many people who I could just blast it out to.
Yeah. I mean, you were just saying some people kind of made fun of you for waiting so long to launch paid plans, but there's not very many SaaS apps that launch into, you know, that into five digits even, right? Like that. That doesn't, usually you start really low, a couple hundred, and then the next month you do more, and the next month you do more, and that's why they call it the long, slow SaaS ramp of death, right? It takes a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I still feel like I'm on that ramp. I just popped the clutch a bit, I guess.
Yeah.
And but, you know, it definitely was stressful not having that revenue for a long time. I mean, the reason why I did it that way is because I didn't want to, you know, one of the reasons why my previous attempts didn't work is we quit our jobs and ran out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to have a limited amount of runway.
Mm-hmm.
That meant that I had to, couldn't devote all my time to it. And it took a lot longer to get to where I wanted to be. But, once I was able to, I'd already built up enough users to. But, you know, I didn't know. I was still praying at that point.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I hope that, because at that point, I think 2 months before that, I was like, okay, I think I'm ready. I'm close enough to launch. I'm out of money. But so I think I took out like 20 grand. I applied for like five credit cards at once. So they wouldn't see each other. Like they wouldn't register. So yeah. I could get, and then so I got like 20 grand in credit. To quit working, and then spent that 2 months launching, and then at that point I was like, okay, I either can either this is gonna work or I'm probably gonna have to go get a job.
So. I mean, that's pretty good. So how many users did that represent? Like, you had 10,000 registered users. How many ended up converting that month?
I think I told you this before the call, I'm not that great at like tracking things and knowing things about the business.
$20? Because the TechCrunch article says it was $20 initially per month, right?
Yeah, it's always been $20. I mean, the first person, the first guy that I asked about this, that who was a podcaster, I asked him, like, how much would you pay? He said $20 a month. I was like, okay. So that was kind of where my pricing came from.
Yeah.
So that's like, he's an advisor in the company now. But.
Cool. So that's like 600 paying users your first month. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I was hoping that it would get at least enough to cover, you know, I was like, if I can get, you know, 6 or 7 grand a month out of this, then I was like 4 or 5. I was like, I could probably make work.
Yeah.
Great
first month. And so how did it grow from there? You'd launched, you've probably still have some headaches around the product. Like, maybe talk a little bit about that. Cause a lot of folks just kind of lead up to launch day and then they're like, okay, you know, they think it's going to be smooth sailing, but do you remember any of the struggles you had back then right after you launched?
Well, one of the big problems that I, and one of the things that I'd probably try and figure out how to handle better next time, if there's a next time, mm-hmm. would be, I really underestimated the gravity of like support requests. It was totally feasible for me to like spend every day just talking to people and not actually making progress on the code base.
Yeah.
Because when you have a product that's like almost what people need, but not quite there, they're going to be talking to you all the time. And, you know, that can be really overwhelming, especially if they're not charging anything.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, there definitely were weeks that went by that I was just handling support requests and doing my contracting and not making progress on the company.
Yeah.
Partially because I just burn out. And just, you know, so
how did you get out of that?
I don't know that I did. I mean, now I have help. I have, you know, customer support reps that help me, you know, field most of the stuff, but you know, they're not like developers. And so a lot of the stuff, you know, if it's a bug, it's hard for them to logically reason about what might be causing it if they're not familiar with the inner workings of it. So a lot of it, I still do have to handle myself. But you know, it is getting, and for the first, I mean, it wasn't until a couple months ago that I took my personal email off of all of our, transactional emails that went out.
Yeah.
Which I still feel kind of bad about, but it just got to be too much. Having those come directly to my inbox. So, now those go to the support tickets.
Yeah. Now, and if we kind of plot your growth, cause that was a year ago, right? That's November, 2016. And now it's November, 2017. Where are you at now? You said 33,000 registered users. What are you doing in MRR now?
So there's about 30,000 registered users. The MRR is around 33,000. The actual net is maybe 5,000 more than that because the, you know, people sign up for yearly plans, or I also have some other revenue that's not recurring. Like, free users can buy like, a la carte post-production credits and things like that.
Okay. Gotcha. So, and how many paying users do you have an idea of that?
Like, yeah.
I guess we could do the math on that. Just even
1500 ish. Something like that.
Okay. Wow.
You a real number if I, let's see, get my metrics. So about 1700 paying customers right now.
Cool. Yeah. So you've basically been able to double the number of paying users and the amount of monthly recurring revenue in a year. What have you been doing to make that happen? Like, has it just been organic? People are just sharing and telling other people about it?
Yeah, I've just been keeping my head above water, really. I think there's actually a lot of headroom as far as like, if I wanted to like really crank up the volume on the marketing and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I still haven't done a lot of stuff that, you know, I did some consulting with you or you with me a while back around, you know, just how to like fix my user flow and A/B test the login page and stuff. And I still haven't even had time to do that.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot. I think I could really, you know, make, you know, pump it up a little bit more if I had time to focus on it. But, you know, I'm at kind of this place where I'm trying to figure out how to grow the company in a way that keeps it fun. Because like my goals going into this were, I want to be economically, you know, financially independent. I want to be geographically independent. So I want to be able to, you know, my wife is from, her family's from New Zealand. She's always dragging me over there. And, and I want to be able to like work from cool places, and I kind of have to sometimes. And then the other thing is I wanted to be decision-making independent. So I didn't want like, you know, investor, you know, I hated the dynamic of like trying to get investors to like believe in you, you know, cause you just feel like you're trying to impress these people and you don't know what they want. And, you know, and you end up catering to the investor rather than the user. And so I was like, I don't want, you know, at least initially I wanted to like get bootstrapped to pop profitability without that. And then, you know, co-founders also can be tricky, you know. If you're not all on the same page, you can kind of compromise everything into, you know, a subpar product, or, you know. And so I wanted to be able to kind of be, you know, if I say that this is the way it is, then this is the way it is, for better or worse, just to cut out the, you know, the time spent deliberating and compromising on things.
Yeah.
So with that said, my, you know, now I'm reaching this point where it's like, okay, well, you probably need to have like an office and a bunch of people where, you know, working and helping you. And, you know, you might want to try and raise some money to dump into marketing and to be able to hire a CTO so you can focus on, you know, and all this stuff. And so, or to hire a CMO and trying to figure out what, you know, what do I really want out of it? Cause it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
If you don't really grab it by the horns and say, this is what I want this to be, it'll become something, and it may not be what, cause I, you know, I kind of created this, so I didn't have to have a real job, and it can, it's, you know, the other thing that I thought I wanted, well, I still want this, but that I thought was possible, is like, I wanted to work like 10 hours a week on something. I did not pick the right product for that.
How much do you think you're working?
All hours a week. There's never time that I don't have stuff to do. I mean, here's another problem with me and growing the company is I'm a very, like, I'm great at, like, for 3 months I can work, you know, 15, 20 hours a day. But then I need, like, a month of, like, really slow, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I get the stuff done, is, like, you know, kind of like a, I don't know, manic, and then... what's the other one? Manic, depressive kind of a thing. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. But like, I work really great in like spurts.
Yeah.
But what it requires now is like steadiness and consistency. And that's not what I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
And so, trying to navigate that. So to answer your question, you know, sometimes like when we just did a big launch to move away from using Dropbox to our own cloud storage. And we had a solid deadline on that because Dropbox was turning off their API.
Okay.
And I didn't sleep for like 4 days straight
working
on that. So that was like the most I've ever worked on it.
Yeah.
But then, you know, and then there's sometimes when I just kind of go into maintenance mode and, you know, I'm not programming much and just trying to keep, you know, handle any support requests that can't be handled without me. And, you know, and sometimes those, but I've never 10 hours a week.
Yeah. Yeah. That part of the dream didn't come alive.
No.
I mean, yeah, this is an interesting point for you. Like you've kind of got to the point now where it's profitable, where it's growing organically really well. But yeah, if you're going to get to the next stage, you have to make some decisions, right? Like, are you going to hire like a bunch of full-time staff? Are you going to have an office? And then you also have to figure out what your role is going to be in the midst of all that, right?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that recently. I mean, I think in my perfect scenario, what I would be doing is building out new features and products.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I like doing. Is breaking new ground with the and programming most of the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we want to start offering hosting plans soon. I'd love to just lock myself in a room for a few weeks and build that and not have to worry about anything else.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things I've learned is you can't really hire people, or at least it's very hard. I haven't figured out how to hire people to do something that you don't know how to do.
Interesting.
To bring someone on to just you can bring someone on to do something for you, but you're not going to get out of having to deal with that yourself,
mm-hmm.
at least initially, and without having a lot of trust with this person as well.
Yeah.
Because you know, I don't know. Maybe other people have found the magic bullet there, but it tends to be that I have to dig in and learn how to do it myself. And then I know exactly what I need and who I should hire and what I should expect from them.
Yeah.
And then I maybe can kind of back off from there, but
yeah, I think that's a pretty common obstacle and there's even some wisdom in that of not hiring anyone for a role that you haven't done yourself. at least a little bit, so you have some sort of sense of what is this, what's actually involved in this, and you know, and even what, how would you know they're doing a good job? Because the best feeling is when you hire someone and then they come along and they are clearly better than you were. But unless you have that baseline of knowing, okay.
You might not know how good they are. You might not know how bad or how good they are if you don't know, have any kind of a baseline, like you said.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's one obstacle you've got, you know, for this coming year, it sounds like, is figuring out how to hire, who to hire next, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, figuring out how to delegate portions of the business out that in ways that free me up to do what I'm good at and also don't cut me completely out of the loop of my business. I mean, like, this is the point where, you know, it would be nice to have a co-founder who could be like, okay, you please be the CEO, include me in any major decisions, and let me just build. But now it gets very complicated if you want to like bring in, you know, some sort of a high powered CMO or CEO to kind of push you to the next level. Cause they're going to be very expensive, either cash wise or equity wise, or probably both.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to figure out. Like, I've been working at this for, you know, what, almost 4 years, and how do you value that, and how do you value the new contribution, and how do you come to like a meeting of the minds from both sides, and then how do you test that and make sure you don't jump into the water too soon without, you know, it's tricky.
Yeah, totally. And do you think, because it sounds like, well, we touched on this a little bit, but like, in terms of what you're planning on improving in your business this year, and one thing you mentioned was new features and new products, is there anything else that you'd like to get out of the business this year that, you know, that you've thought about? Like, oh yeah, 2018 would be great if we, you know, grew to this many users, or we were able to implement this, or I was able to, you know, cut myself out of customer support. What kinds of improvements are you looking for in 2018?
You know, I don't have, my revenue goals aren't that, I don't know if my goals are typically based around revenue. Maybe they should be. I think over the next 12 months, it wouldn't be crazy to get to like a million ARR or something like that. With, you know, but I'd probably need some help with that. But the things that get me excited is like, I mean, A, I want to be able to pay for, you know, I want to be able to have enough money to travel. Someday I'd like to be able to buy first class tickets when I travel. That's what I want money for.
Yeah.
But aside from that, like, I just get excited about building stuff. It's really cool to be in a space where the field is kind of wide open, because this technology didn't exist before. And so there's all kinds of new cool stuff that could be built. There's a bunch of new features. Like, I mean, hosting plans are kind of a obvious thing for the future of Zencastr. All kinds of stuff about, you know, matching people with advertisers, you know, adding video support, being able to then bring in some of those ideas that I was originally working on with the audio workstation, so you could do some of your audio editing in Zencastr. Let's see, what else is kind of, I don't know, like, just making it more of like a one-stop shop. Right now, podcasting is very like spread out across lots of different services. It's really hard for a new podcaster because they're like, well, yeah, we'll help you record, but then if you need hosting, you got to talk to these guys, and then they're going to help you probably publish this RSS feed, and that's going to got to go to iTunes, and then you got all these, like, you're going to be on Spotify or SoundCloud, you know, there's all this, like, this big network of services you have to kind of know about and be aware of. And I think consolidating that is is happening, and will continue to happen. And so just figuring out ways to do that, like making the soundboard in Zencastr. I really like the idea of, like, instead of doing a bunch of editing and post-production, making it so that you can drop in your intros and outros and whatever sounds and things during the call.
Yeah, just on the fly. Save
on the fly. And so more of like a live radio kind of thing. Live streaming. Like,
yeah.
Did you ever use Blab?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Blab was so cool. I was so stunned when they closed the doors because I actually kind of get chills now thinking about the experience that they created. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think if I had time to just build stuff, I might start working in that direction because I think it's a shame that experience is gone.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, like, because you're clearly really, you get really excited about the product side of it. What about, like, is that, some of that is just your own interest, but some of that, it sounds like, is coming from customers. Like, how have you stayed in touch with your customers? Has that just been, you know, doing customer support for so long? And when you're thinking about those things, are you thinking about specific customers that are, like, wanting those things? Or is it more like, oh, I just want to build that stuff?
Yeah, all of the above, I think. I mean, it's definitely a rush when you see somebody tweeting like, oh wow, this is the coolest new thing I've ever, you know, mm-hmm. on Twitter. Like, that's great. Yeah. It also is a real downer when someone says something bad, but
yeah.
So I get a good, you know, I've had to rely heavily on users because, I mean, we didn't really talk about this, but I wasn't a podcaster.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm now recording a podcast. I haven't never had time to launch it because I've been so busy just like keeping the thing running. But, you know, I've had to rely very heavily on user feedback to know what's needed.
Yeah.
Luckily, that hasn't been a problem. I get more feedback than I can handle, really.
Yeah.
But maybe sorting through it and figuring out what's the really important pieces are. But, you know, some of them are just obvious when you're getting, you know, every other person is asking you for like a mobile app. You're like, okay, well, maybe I should have a mobile app.
Do you have a mobile app right now? Or that's
not, I don't know. I don't. I'd love to. Yeah. But that's another thing. It's like, I just don't have the momentum for it right now. Like,
yeah.
It would be a whole separate code base. I'd need at least one full-time dedicated person on that. And it's not something that would go away. You can't just build it. Like, there's so many people that want to offer you a service or they're like, we'll charge you $80,000 and we'll build this app for you.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that's not, it's not like that just is going to be done after that. So it's more than just paying for an app. You have to build a team for that. And it's easily one of the most highly requested features, but it's just not the right move right now. But next year, you know.
Yeah, that might be something else you add to your roadmap.
Yeah.
Is there like a certain customer type that's emerged? Like, you started just talking to your friends, but then, you know, you actually had people coming out of the woodwork to pay for this. Is there a certain type of person that buys Zencastr?
That's a good question. Again, I don't know enough about the broad demographics, I think, as I should, but you know, one thing I've learned is that there are definitely different categories of users. Like, you've got the kind of the brand new, there's a big span as far as like experience level.
Mm-hmm.
People that don't know anything about audio or technology or podcasting, and they just have of what they want to say something.
Yeah.
And this is how they want to do it. All the way back to people who've been podcasting since the day one, and they've got $20,000 studio at home, and so that's across the, you know,
that's there's the spectrum, that, yeah.
That's the spectrum there, and then but you've also got like, as far as like, I guess you could think of it as like business mindedness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of these are, a lot of these are like college kids playing League of Legends and want to talk about like the latest hero that became available, you know, or whatever. And yeah. That's why I always want to keep a free plan, because I love facilitating that. And
yeah.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
The hard part is those ones typically want to have, those are also the people that want to have like five people and all their friends.
Yeah.
And so figuring out how to have the free plans be more permissive in that way, but still you know, finding ways to keep business users. Anyway, I'm rambling there, but yeah, it goes on to like, you know, then you've got, I think the people who are doing well, you know, or who are actually like making money podcasting are people who have a side business or a side product, and the podcast is the funnel for them.
Gotcha.
And then you do have that top tier of people who've got, you know, hundreds or thousands or millions of listeners who just run ads and that's their thing. But mm-hmm. most, I would say that's rare, very rare.
Yeah. So you'd say most of the people paying for Zencastr are folks that, you know, they have some sort of product or service and they're using the podcast as marketing.
Yeah, people are using it as a marketing channel.
It's interesting because I think when people are dreaming up ideas, like if I was dreaming up a podcast app, I'd be like, oh, you know, it'd probably be, I think of a lot of hobby podcasters or, you know, people talking about their favorite board games or their favorite video games. And then maybe I can think of really popular podcasters that make lots of money in ad revenue. But for you, like the customers that have emerged are kind of these business people that are, this is just like another way for them to communicate to their customers, right?
Yeah. I'm seeing more and more that like a podcast is just kind of becoming another facet of like your marketing strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you're going to need to blog, you're going to have maybe do your SEO stuff, let's get a podcast going.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one of those boxes to tick. And that's why it's really important that it's super easy.
Yeah.
Because it's not like their sole purpose, right?
Yeah.
And for a lot of them, it's like the way it's being sold to them is like, hey, you want to have blog posts, but those are kind of hard to create and do well and they take time. But if you just have 45 minutes, you know, like a lot of what's happening is like producers are getting clients and then telling them, hey, give me 45 minutes of your time. We'll meet you at Zencastr. I'll schedule it. You come in, they'll come in. I'll be there. We'll record. I'll edit it for you. Bam. So it's really just like, you know, in a lot of cases, the host is not even pressing record.
Like, yeah, it's these other folks. And yeah. It's so interesting. Like you would have never been able to guess that back in, now I'm going back again, back in November, 2014, you'd have never been able to guess that those would have been your paying users really. Right. Cause you didn't have the information.
Yeah, I had no idea. Like, I had no idea about the business or economics of podcasting or like any of it. It was really just kind of like on a whim because this guy told me he'd pay me $20 a month. You know,
and maybe we'll end on this. I make this the last question, but kind of along those lines, what do you think aspiring product people get wrong about, you know, building products? What mistakes are they making early on, or what kind of wrong thinking do they have?
I think I think the information gathering phase can take too long. Mm. I think a lot of people just read books and books and books about business and mm-hmm. don't ever actually get started.
Yeah.
I think that the...
So put something out. Like even if it, in your case, if you hadn't been working on Soundscape...
Soundkeep is what it was.
Sorry, Soundkeep. You would have never met that guy at Techstars. You would have never heard that thing. It was the process of making things and putting it out that...
Yeah, you got to put your neck out there. And even heading in the complete wrong direction is going to be faster, I think, in a lot of cases, than trying to read books about what you should do forever, you know?
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, depending on what your business is... But it was really struck me how useful Twitter is. And even though people like get down on Twitter's business model or whatever, I own stock in Twitter because of this. I'm like,
yeah,
it was so important, you know, for me to be able to access those people. Like in the future, I probably, if I was having like a consumer facing product at all, mm-hmm. I would probably not do anything unless I could find dozens, if not hundreds, of people complaining about this problem on Twitter. Because that's what people do on Twitter, is they complain.
Yeah.
And if they're not complaining on Twitter, then maybe there's not a problem.
Yeah. That's great. I think we'll end it there. Josh, thanks so much, man.
Yeah,
folks that are interested in Zencastr can go to the website. It's zencastr.com. And Josh is on the web at Josh on the web. He's on Twitter at Josh on the web. And then there's also Zencastr Twitter handle. Anything else people should know about?
No, I think we covered it in depth.
Perfect. Great. Thanks so much for doing this, man.
Yeah.
All right. So that is episode 91. You can go to productpeople.tv/91 and get all of the show notes. Thanks again to Josh. And go to megamaker.co/club. Go to for the Product People Club. That's now called Mega Maker Club. And go to megamaker.co/profit if you want me to email you all of these case studies, including one from Brennan Dunn, Nick DeSabato, lots more coming up in 2018. And I will see you next time.
I think there are some good takeaways, but I really do think like most of it is like A, I got lucky, and B, I just kind of kept moving, you know,
like yeah. But there's some key things like I think Twitter giving you access to what people are complaining about is an interesting insight, because often people will try to pull it out of folks like, hey, what are you struggling with, or that whenever I get that question, it's usually they're asking me at the wrong time. Like if someone emails me and goes, hey, I really want to know what you're struggling with. I might not be struggling with anything at that moment. But if you look, you know, on my Twitter feed, I've probably complained about dozens of things, you know, along the way. Or if you were working in my office here with me, you might be able to observe me like swearing or getting frustrated with something. Then you can see it. But you know, just like emailing someone out of the blue and going, hey, so what are you struggling with right now? Nothing.
Yeah, I agree, because I get emails like that too, where, you know, especially like it'll be existing services that I use, and they're like, what's your biggest pain point? Because they're trying to build out new products. I'm like, oh, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
But I bet you could even, like, if you just search Twitter for, like, fuck.
Yeah.
And just browse for a good while, you'd start to see like them complaining about something that maybe you had an interest in. And then you could like go from there.
Totally. But I've often searched so frustrated with.
And yeah,
like,
there you go.
If you like search that, it's like number one is like so frustrated with Sprint right now.